Cliff Goldstein here again, and I want to start out with a quote from the great Russian writer Leo Tolstoy, because I think it makes a very good point about what I think is the most basic question a person could ask, and that question is, what is the purpose of my life? Now, I grew up reading a lot of Russian writers as a kid in high school, but I pretty much focused mostly on Dostoevsky. I never really read much Tolstoy. I think I was scared about the size of his books, you know, War and Peace and all that. I mean, I felt like you needed a crane to carry those books around. So I really never got to Tolstoy. Well, a couple years ago, I went on a trip. And before I went on the trip, my wife got me a book of short stories by Tolstoy. And I really wasn't that interested in it, but I was sitting in my bed and I figured I'll read something to help me go to sleep. And I read this short story in here by Tolstoy. It's called How Much Land Does a Man Need? And it tells the story about a poor peasant. His name was Pahom. And Pahom was just so frustrated because they were in poverty, and he said they needed land. And in one place in the story, early on, he says, if I had plenty of land, I shouldn't fear the devil himself. Then in the story it goes, all right, thought the devil, we will have a tussle. I will give you land enough, and by means of that land, I will get you in my power. So anyway, I don't know if he knows the devil said that. But anyway, Pahom then goes, he goes to a place called the land of the Bashirs. And the Bashirs will sell you land. And they tell him, we'll sell you the land at 1,000 rubles a day. And Pahom's thinking, 1,000 rubles a day, what does that mean? And they tell him, look, you walk, and all the land you can walk around in a single day, that'll be all your land. You go and you just place markers on the border, and what you can walk around in a single day, all that land is yours in one day for just 1,000 rubles. But there's one catch. They tell them that it'll all be yours, but there is one condition. If you don't return on the same day to the spot whence you started, your money is lost. In other words, he got nothing. Well, Pahom can't believe it. This is incredible. So he starts walking and walking and walking and going to one edge and he's going to another and he's just getting all this land and he's so excited. He's just getting this thing and he sees something. He goes, let me go a little further and get that. And he's just visioning all the great things he's going to have. And he's walking and walking and he's just getting all this land. And then he suddenly realizes, wow, the sun is starting to set. I've got to be back here in time. And he starts running and running. And then suddenly he realizes he might not make it. He might not make it. And again, the story is called How Much Land Does a Man Need? And he runs and he gets right up to the end. And he's running and he's running. And then the next thing you know, he collapses. He falls down and he collapses dead. And that's pretty much, you know, right before he gets to the end. And that's the story. How much land does a man need? And this is how it ends. His servants picked up the spade and dug a grave long enough for Pahom to lie in and buried him in it. 6 feet from his head to his heels was all he needed. How much land does a man need? 6 feet from his head to his heels. Well, the bottom line in all that, I was hooked. I just started reading everything I could of Tolstoy since then, and I still got more to read. I've read some biographies of him. I love him. It's wonderful stuff. And one of his novels, and that's the one I want to talk about today, is Anna Karenina. And it's a story about a woman who, you know, just ended up having an affair and brought, you know, ruin on her family and on and on and on. I mean, he's got, you know, one of the few writers I got to take notes and name the characters in here because, you know, they have one character after another and another and so on. But the point is, towards the end of his book, he's got a character named Konstantin Levin. And Levin was all through the story. And towards the end of the book, he's a wealthy landowner and he's got his property. And at one point, you know, he's talking about the people he's seeing on the farm, and then they're going to live, and then they're going to die, and then his other friend is live, and he's going to die, and then eventually he knows he's going to die, and he wonders, what's it all for? And then he asks this question. Here's the quote that I really wanted to focus on, because I think, again, well, as I read it, I think you'll see my point. All that day, while talking to the bailiff and the peasants, at home with his wife, with Dolly, her children, and his father-in-law, Levin's thoughts were busy with one and only one subject outside his farming. That interested him at the time, and in everything he sought a bearing on his question: where am I? What am I? And why am I here? Now, you know, you think about it. Those are pretty basic questions. I mean, we're here. We exist. What is the purpose of our lives? I remember one of my favorite authors. Actually, he's not really one of my favorite. When I was a kid, I loved him. Jack Kerouac, On the Road, and founder of the Beat Generation. But in one place, he was talking about how he met some waitress in a restaurant and was trying to talk her up and everything. And then he says, "What do you want to do with your out of life?" I asked, as I used to ask all the time of girls. "I don't know," she said. "Just wait on tables and try to get along." Well, is that what it's all about? Just wait on tables and try to get along? Is that what people's lives are reduced to? I mean, who of us hasn't asked that question at some point? I mean, you got to be a mindless zombie at some point not to ask the question, what am I doing here? I mean, we exist. We're here. We didn't come with an explanation. Who of us choose to be here? We're all in the same boat in the sense that none of us chose to exist. We just found ourselves here. I didn't ask to be born, and I bet my last dollar that any of you listen, and you didn't ask to be born either. We're just here. But then the question is, but why? What are we here for? And if you really think about it, I mean, it's really not an unreasonable question, is it? I mean, how fruitless, in a sense, idiotic to live your whole life, to go on and on and on, to go through all the hassles and all the struggles of life and not even know why you're here. How do you answer these questions? Well, I'd like to tell you how one person answered these questions, and that was the Frenchman Jean-Paul Sartre. Now, Sartre was somewhat notorious in his time. He was a hardcore atheist. He was born, I think, the late 1800s. He came out of the carnage of two world wars and had a pessimistic view of the world. And he lived with his lover, Simone de Beauvoir, and he was leaning towards Marxism. I mean, one of the last images I remember of Sartre was Germany in the 70s, a couple of these terrorists, the Bader-Meinhof gang had pretty much terrorized Germany, had the whole country to a standstill, and they finally arrested them and stuck them in jail. And before they committed suicide, Sartre had visited them in jail. And so he was kind of on the one sense, he was very notorious. And yet he was, in many ways, one of the most influential philosophers of the last century. People still read about him. I just finished, I didn't bring it with me, but Annie Solal Cohen wrote a nice long biography of Sartre. And if you're interested, it's a good biography to read, if you have an interest in this guy. But anyway, the question is, I want to come back now to Konstantin Levin's questions. Who am I? Where am I? Why am I here? Let me tell you how I think Jean-Paul Sartre would answer them. The first question, why am I here? So, you know, what am I? The first question, what am I? Sartre would say, you are what you make yourself out to be. The second question, where am I? Sartre would say, you're where you choose to place yourself. And the third question, and why am I here? Sartre would say, the question's irrelevant. You're just here. Now deal with it. And I think here we've got basically the foundation of Sartre's philosophy. And it's basically, it's called existentialism. And we'll get into that a little while. The word is used pretty loosely. But I think one of the main features of this philosophy, and I think its ultimate flaw, and as we'll see, is that it pretty much denies the importance of human origins. Sartre basically ignores them. They're not part of his scheme. He goes on as if where we came from didn't make any difference at all. And that, I think, is ultimately the crucial, fundamental flaw that ultimately wipes out the whole premise of all his philosophy and the whole existentialist movement to begin with. Now, let's get logical here. If you want to understand the purpose of something, you would look at its origins, its causes, would you not? I mean, what's its purpose? How is it to be used? And why is it used? I mean, let's say you buy a coffee maker or an espresso machine. Now, just decaf now. Now, it comes designed, obviously, for a specific purpose. Intentions are implied, even explicit, in the device itself. Its purposes are built into the machine. You don't have to come and devise them after. They were already there, pre-ordered and pre-packaged in the machine. If it's used for something else, how well is it going to work? I mean, take an espresso machine and try blow-drying your hair with an espresso machine, and you'll see what I mean. Now, my point on all this is that the coffee machine is that its purpose existed even before the coffee machine did. The answer to those three questions, what's its purpose, how is it used, and why, you know, precede the machine itself. See, they had to be in order for the machine to become what it was. Those who created the coffee machine, they did so with those questions and those answers already in mind. You know, it wasn't as if some factory somewhere, a bunch of guys got together and they stuck this piece in here and they stuck that piece in there and they stuck that and turned it on and said, whoops, wow, this thing would be good for making espresso drinks. No, that's not how it worked. The purpose was there already. The purpose was in the machine. It was before they made the machine. It was pre-programmed in it. Sartre would say that its purposes, its reason for being, came before the being itself. Its essence to, now here's a fancy phrase, let's listen. Its essence, he would say, preceded its existence. What does that mean? Essence precedes existence. Basically, it's saying that its purposes, it predated it. The purposes were there before the thing was. The idea existed in someone's mind, and then they made the thing for itself, period. Let me quote you him here. Come on. Okay. This is Sartre's book, Existentialism and Human Emotions. It's a shorter version of this other long book he wrote on the ontology of phenomenology, which is a long, hard read. But anyway, here's what Sartre says. Okay, he's talking about a penknife, and here's the essence of it. Let us consider some object that is manufactured. For example, a book or a paper cutter. Here is an object which has been made by an artisan whose inspiration came from a concept. He referred to the concept of what a paper cutter is and likewise to a known method of production, which is part of the concept, something which is by nature, by large routine. Thus, the paper cutter is at once an object produced in a certain way and, on the other hand, one having a specific use. One cannot postulate a man who produces a paper cutter but does not know what it is used for. Therefore, let us say for the paper cutter essence, that is the ensemble of both the production routine and the properties which enable it to be both produced and defined, precede existence. Okay? In other words, he's saying with the book, with the paper cutter, like an espresso machine, the concepts of them, their purposes, their essences, all existed before they good. They, you know, before they did. The idea was there, and then the thing was made. Okay? Capiche? So far? Okay. Now, that makes sense enough. That makes sense. Now, Sartre then talks about God as the creator of man, and he draws an analogy. Just as the paper cutter was in the mind of the artisan before he made the object, so he's saying man was in the mind of God before he made man. Let me read you Sartre here. Okay? Thus, this is important now, because here's where we're getting to the heart of it all. Thus, the concept of man is in the mind of God. The concept of man in the mind of God is comparable to the concept of a paper cutter in the mind of the manufacturer. Okay? So what he's saying is that just as the manufacturer had the idea of a paper cutter in his mind, God had the idea of man in his mind. Okay? That makes sense, doesn't it? You know, makes sense. But now, though, we get to the heart of the matter. Okay, paper cutter is in the mind of the man who makes the paper cutter, and then he makes the paper cutter. Man is in the mind of God. God makes man. The idea of man first, and then man. Here's the problem, though. Sartre doesn't believe in God. doesn't believe that some divine mind thought of humanity and then created on the basis of those thoughts, created man. Sartre, as I said, he was a hardcore atheist. He was a hardcore take-no-prisoner atheist. So for in his thinking, here's where the paper analogy stops, paper cutter analogy stops. A paper cutter had to have a maker, had to have someone who conceived of it and then brought it into existence. Humanity, according to Sartre, didn't. No one conceived us in Sartre's mind, no one planned us, no one thought out the idea of us and then brought us here. And then Sartre says, if God does not exist, then there is at least one being in whom existence precedes essence, a being who exists before he can be defined by any concept, and this being is man. See, what he's saying here, we're born essentially without meaning, we're born without purpose, we're born without goals because none of these things preceded us or were placed in us before we got here. According to Sartre, basically, we're just here. And if we want meaning, if we want purpose, if we've got goals, then we're going to have to conjure them up from ourselves because they didn't come with us. They weren't wired in our DNA. They weren't in our bones. We weren't preordained for anything. We just, boom, we're just here. Again, Sartre. It means that, first of all, this is what he's saying, what existentialism is. It means that, first of all, man exists, turns up, appears on the scene, and only afterwards defines himself. If man, as the existentialist conceives him, is indefinable, it is because at first he is nothing. Only afterward he will be something, and he will be what he will make himself to be. Now, again, according to Sartre, no God thought us up, no God gave us purpose, so we really, at first, we don't have any purpose. We just is, we just are, we just exist, inherently meaningless, inherently purposeless, with no history or pre-existence justification. Human life is essentially meaningless, because Sartre said, in and of itself, he said, no God gave us meaning, and therefore, in and of itself, is meaningless. Sartre also said, man is nothing else but what he makes himself. Such is the first principle of existentialism. Now, on one level, you think that's quite logical and that's quite plausible. We're responsible for what we become. We're responsible for what we do. We are responsible for the choices we make. We each one, individually, we personally, we are free to make our lives out what we want them to be. You know, on one level, it all sounds so good. On the other level, I got a few issues with the guy, okay? To begin, you got this idea of humanity, and humanity as a whole is at first nothing. I think what he means is that our lives are meaningless until we give them meaning. So is that saying that these millions of 20-some-year-olds out there who don't quite got it all together yet, who don't quite know the meaning of their lives are meaningless? You know, what about the millions of folks out there who perhaps are still not sure what it's all about? Because they don't have answers for it, their lives are meaningless? And then he's got this other problem that comes too, is that this idea, does something become meaningful only when we attribute purpose and meaning? I mean, see, in other words, he's saying it doesn't have meaning until we give it meaning. Well, okay, think about for a minute. Oh, think about the human appendix, okay? Let's think about our appendix. For years and years and years, weren't we told that, you know, was that a vestigial organ left over from evolution? It's got no purpose, you know? So for years and years and years, people didn't believe that the appendix had any meaning, any function. They didn't know what it was for. Well, let me see if I got it here. I pulled off the internet. They don't believe that anymore. Here's something I got off the internet about the function of the appendix. The function of the appendix appears to be to expose white blood cells to the wide variety of antigens or foreign substances present in the gastrointestinal tract. Thus, the appendix probably helps suppress potentially destructive humoral antibody responses. On and on. The point. Did the appendix not do these things? Did these things not do to we attributed to them? Did the appendix not expose white blood cells to antigens and all that? Why? But before we knew that it did? Of course not. Of course not. It had those things before we attributed it to them. So then the question I would ask is, then do we as humans, do we have no meaning? Do we have no purpose to our lives? And lives that are composed of a lot more things than some little gizmo right here in our guts. Do we have no meaning until we finally attribute meaning to them? Do we have to know the purpose of our existence in order for that existence to have purpose? Any more than we had to know the purpose of the appendix in order for the appendix to have purpose? I mean, if the appendix had a purpose before we discovered it, isn't it also the same for our lives, incredibly more complex than our appendix? Now, and there's another part too with Sartre that I find really problematic. It's this idea that he says man exists, turns up and appears on the scene, and only afterward he defines himself. Now you think about that for a minute. He starts out with mankind as some sort of foundational principle, an assumption that doesn't need any proof. We're just here. It's like we almost start out like an axiom in geometry. Man just sort of turns up and appears on the scene as if, for Sartre, how man happens, and by man I mean women too, of course. I'm going to cover myself on that. We just turn up out of nowhere, and as where we came from is irrelevant. You know, this is kind of strange if you think about it, you know, to take man as, you know, our automatic assumption as a presupposition. I mean, consider, you know, in many ways, it's very unlikely that we're here. I'm sure some of you have seen some of those numbers, you know, that it's 1 to the 10th of the 20th for this organ to have formed and 1 to the 10th of the 50th for this thing to have formed. I mean, some of the numbers that scientists use for our existence make it seem like there was more. You got more of a chance of winning 5 big-time lotteries in a row than for human beings to exist. Whether we're here by chance or divine decree, we're not axiomatic to anything. We're as likely to be the conclusion of a whole bunch of processes that preceded us as we are to be the starting point of whatever comes after. So I guess my point is for him to use humanity, human existence, and human consciousness as a presupposition, as the starting point. You know, it's almost like doing a math problem, you know, starting at the 13th step. You got 13, but you ignore the 13 steps before you and just start at 1. I mean, no matter how good your logic after, there's always going to be the question, how valid were the steps that got you there? I mean, would you really want to live in a house? Live in a building whose foundation was made out of plywood, where everything else was made out of rubble? And see, this is the big problem I see with Sartre. And it gets worse, because I think with Sartre, you know, Sartre, we have no, you know, we're like an empty book in which we alone, we write the story. Okay, like the book is empty, but even, you know, a book, which is Sartre's own example, implies an artisan, implies someone who had the idea of a book and then made the book. You know, even a blank book just isn't. Is to have a blank book, it had to come from somewhere. Somebody had to make it. And yet we're supposed to believe that a human being, infinitely more complex than a book, is greater than the book. You know, think for a minute of Da Vinci and the Mona Lisa. Did the Mona Lisa, you know, you think about the Mona Lisa. You know, it obviously had an essence, okay? In other words, saying somebody had to think of the Mona Lisa before it got there, okay? So there was an essence that preceded the existence of the Mona Lisa. And that was, you know, Da Vinci. Yet, according to Sartre, we're saying Da Vinci didn't, there was no essence to Da Vinci before we got there. He didn't have an essence prior to existence. If the creation needed an essence, how much more its creator? It would be like the chicken being less complex than in the egg that comes out of it. It doesn't make sense. I like this quote from, this is a very interesting guy, Lawrence von der Post. I'll be quoting him more. South African. It's a book called A Walk with a White Bushman. Interesting guy. And I like this quote from von der Post. And do not forget, it is a law of creation that which is created can never be greater than the thing that created it. So Sartre says that all these things, you know, admits that a paper knife, a book, all these things had to have an essence beforehand, and then yet a human being, infinitely more complex, didn't have one. didn't have one. You know, it makes me, can you see where I see a problem with that? You know, things are, where all these other things have, these simpler things, all had an essence before they existed. And then we human beings, we come along and we don't have any essence before we just created ourselves. I don't think it works. I don't think it works. I mean, ultimately, if this is a meaningless universe, you know, meaningless universe, beings created out of meaningless matter by meaningless forces, how do we even get the idea of meaning? You know, the greatest Marvel, you know, where did the idea of meaning come from? How did meaningless atoms and neutrons and protons and all that, not made with any meaning, how did they suddenly acquire meaning? Where do we get this idea for meaning as well? I mean, a fisherman can fish all day long in a swimming pool, but he's never going to catch a fish if there's no fish in it. You can have the greatest marble sculptor in the world, and he can hem and he can haw and all this, but he's never going to be able to breathe life. The thing will never become alive because it wasn't there to begin with. So according to Sartre, it's all meaningless, it's all purposeless, and then we meaningless, purposeless beings somehow or another give ourselves meaningless and purposeless. I just don't think it works. I don't think it makes sense at all. You know, there was a physicist named Steven Weinberg, and Weinberg was well known. He won the Nobel Prize a few years ago, and he made a statement. He made a statement that the more the universe seems comprehensible, the more it seems pointless. And it's become a famous statement, even though he kind of backtracked from it. But I think his point was simply that, you know, there's no meaning inherent in the universe. We have to give ourselves meaning. And that's the essence of what Sartre said. There's no meaning at all. We have to create the meaning for it. We have to try to make it ourselves. And yet, again, I ask, if there's no purpose to creation, if there was no purpose to it, if everything was ultimately purposeless, if there were no, to quote Sartre, essences before their existence, then how can we, all ultimately made out of meaningless things, how could we ever find any? I don't think we can. Hence, if you're not ready to concede that your life is meaningless, then I think you better start looking for answers somewhere else than what Jean-Paul Sartre offers.